Welcome to the Beekeeper's Corner Podcast.
November 17th, 2013, episode number 46, More to Come. Welcome, everybody, to the Beekeeper's Corner Podcast. This is your host, Kevin England. The host with the most. I hate when people say that. I can't believe I did that. Anyway, you know, at the end of the beekeeping season, you typically run out of things to say, but you know what? The pile is pretty deep over here, and today I am going to run through a number of them and make that pile a little bit smaller. I have a number of topics to bring you. The first one we'll talk about is something called honey powder. Then we'll talk about CCD. I want to go through the life and times of CCD to get a little refresher there. I'm going to bring up a journal article on Nosema and pesticide, the link between the two, to follow on what we said in episode number 45. I want to introduce a moisture board, if you've never heard of one of those, and somewhat I'm not familiar with, so somewhat interested in bringing that topic to bear. We're going to sit back and enjoy a hot Aussie drink. We'll talk about movie night recap, Girl Scouts of Lexington, and jury duty. We'll close out the show, and then we'll have some closing comments and send you on home. It's a Sunday night here in New Jersey. Just finished watching the last NASCAR series race for the season. Not a lot of people watch NASCAR, but I do, and I'm going to be sad because I have to wait till February to see anything. Congratulations to Jimmy Johnson on his sixth title. It's just an amazing feat. I had one opportunity to meet Jimmy Johnson in person when he raced for Excedrin, which was a Bristol-Myers Squibb brand. And unfortunately, work overtook the event and I didn't get to go. How I regret that these days, but I digress. Let's get into our episode here. And that always starts with the local hive report. It was 65 degrees today and a little overcast. That followed a 60-degree day yesterday. Why share this with you? Yesterday, I did my last manipulation for the year. In episode 45, I shared that two of our hives were robbed in late October, early November, and do not have the 60 to 80 pounds of honey recommended to overwinter in New Jersey. They do have, however, a full complement of bees, and I'm not inclined to let them perish over winter. So, for hives 1 and 3, I did two activities yesterday. I opened hive 3, and I put an emery shim in between the two deep boxes. An emery shim is just that, a 3/4-inch spacer that allows a gap between the two boxes. I had some fondant that I made earlier in the year stashed in the freezer. I pulled it out this week and allowed it to defrost and then put it on this hive. The bees immediately got to work on it, which is a good sign. I pulled the inner cover off the box and then put a different style 2-screen shim on top. This device is a frame that has 2 screens on each side with a space in the middle. It separates the hive below from what is above. My next action was to take the hive off of the PVC stand in position 1 in my apiary and locate the bottom box on top of the dual screen shim. My objective is to combine the chamber between the two hives and allow them as much as possible to share the heat generated. So now hive 1 is sitting on top of hive number 3. I placed a second emery shim on top of that box and put fondant on hive number 1 also, so the bees would have something to eat and maybe some reserves. I did not take the upper box from hive number 1 and put it on the stack. It was of no use, being it was empty of all stores. I did put a quilt insulation box on top of the whole stack, and then the inner cover and outer cover. Now, given that I cracked all the seals doing this, I took some blue painter's tape and taped up some of the seams in hopes that it will help them in case they didn't get things patched up from my undoing. To that note, there was a reason I talked to you about the temps yesterday and today. I knew the temps were going to be unseasonably warm today. It played a factor in the strategy to make this move, and I was waiting for a few warm days to execute the change. It is supposed to be warm again tomorrow, so they have 3 days to get to work on things and get the things where they need them to be. I spent the better part of the day splitting wood today, and the bees were all out, all over the place, front of the property, back of the property, side of the property. They were very active in it. If I could guess, I would say they were after two things, water and propolis, given what I did to them. In fact, it's funny, I think the smell of fresh wood was a significant draw because we were getting inspected all day by the scout bees. I'd like to think that they were looking for tree resins, but that might be wishful thinking on my part, and I'm making that up. But they were definitely attracted to whatever we were doing because they were with us all day long. So in the end, these two hives are now stacked on each other, and hopefully this combination will provide what it takes to make it to spring. I will take the opportunity to feed them over winter if the situation presents, and see if I can keep them sustainable until the spring nectar flow. I'm kind of interested in the prospect of trying to get the upper hive through the winter in one box. The challenge is not unlike trying to overwinter a nuc in my mind, but in a 10-frame configuration instead of 5 over 5. For those that don't follow it, a nuc box is 5 frames wide, and you typically overwinter in 2 nucs, one above the other. The one other activity I did yesterday was to move the newest hive we have in the main apiary area. Say that 5 times fast. This is the swarm hive that we caught in June, and it was sitting on an adjacent area to our main apiary area. I moved this hive over to slot number 1. Now all 4 hives are sitting together in the same area of the property, and they are nestled in for the winter. Barring any additional feeding, I am done for the year. Stick a fork in me. That brings to close our local hive report, and from here on in, we'll likely have an abbreviated report through to the spring. To me, this time of year is when I start to get philosophical on what I've learned, but I won't get ahead of myself. Let me save what I've learned for our end of 2013 show. Now, I have a number of things lined up in this episode, but I'm going to get one thing out of the way now before we jump in, and that is our context, info, and insights. All of our previous episode, along with the topics, are available in our show notes for each episode that has come before. You can get those at www.bkcorner.org. Any questions about our podcast can reach me via email. My address is kevin@bkcorner.org. While I'm running down links and contact data, let me share just 2 more. I encourage you to visit youtube.com/nwnjba. That's a YouTube channel that I curate for our Beekeepers Association. It also has content that I create in conjunction with the podcast. Also, you can follow along on a number of things between episodes on the BK Corner Facebook page. That address is facebook.com/beekeeperscorner. Beekeepers Corner is all one word there. One last thing to add, and then we'll get to business. I wanted to say hello and thanks to the note that John Foreman sent me. John hails from Nashville, Tennessee, and is looking to make the leap into beekeeping soon, and has been listening to our back catalog to get up to speed. I receive a number of emails from listeners who go back and listen to our episodes over and over again. There are times I question my sanity on the effort it takes to dedicate oneself to putting these podcasts together. I am a one-horse band, I must say. One-man band, that's the better way to say it. The podcast recordings, the research, the website, all of that stuff comes out of my head. Where, I don't know, but anyway. So these emails that come through always help, especially when I hear listeners are going back through the catalog and getting value out of them. To that end, I think about this notion, and I wonder if it makes sense to eliminate or move the local hive report to the end of the episode. this might make sense for those that listen to something after the fact, and I always wondered if they just flat out hate the local hive report and wish it would go away. Yes, I guess I'm thinking about these things, and maybe too much. That's it. Let's get started. For segment number one, I want to talk about a product called honey powder. I have to slow down here. I'm flying tonight. I know that some folks have written me and said I speak too fast. It's that New Jersey, New York thing where we talk very quickly. Okay. We have the fortune of having an Asian and Indian supermarket near my workplace. In fact, they are literally next door to each other. I like to cook, and one of my team members at work is Asian, so I asked him if he could give me a tour. I was in search of different ingredients, and I had been there once before, but I couldn't discern one product from another brand-wise. Kevin Moment, if you brought someone from overseas and sent them to the store to buy mayonnaise, would they buy Hellmann's or Miracle Whip? They're both mayonnaise, right? Not. That might have been one of the earliest Kevin Moments ever. End of Kevin Moment. So I wanted him to give me guidance on which fish sauce he used, or what tempura batter is his favorite, and so on. And I have to tell you, I admit it, I had a blast in the store. Another side jaunt about the experience is having the fortune of asking what things were that were totally unfamiliar to me. Trust me when I say there are a lot of those things in that store. So to the point of this segment, there was a point. One of the things I saw there was unfamiliar. It was a product called honey powder. Honey powder. Never heard of such a thing until that day. There was honey powder in a jar, and next to it was something called cactus honey powder. What the heck are these things? Immediately, I read the ingredient, and honey powder was indeed honey in dried form. So my first questions were, how do you get it in this form? Why is it white? Did it get bleached? If it were dried honey, wouldn't it be yellow or brown? It looked a little like powdered sugar. Was it mislabeled? I took a short video of my phone, and I figured I could do research about these things when I got home. And I'm glad that I did that, and now I'm telling you about it. So here's what I found. Honey powder is dry or dehydrated honey. One of the problems when baking with honey is dealing with moisture in honey. Most cooking is a pinch here, a shake there, but baking requires a bit more discipline, and baking with honey as a substitute for sugar becomes difficult because sometimes it throws the balance of a recipe off because of the added moisture in the honey. With dried honey, this would not be a problem. My guess is that you could use this much in the same way you would use table sugar. Besides the use for baking, this has possibilities for sprinkling on cereal or other places where someone might consider using powdered sugar. Off the top of my head, I could think about dry rubs for barbecue. I don't know if you'd use powdered sugar for that, but you could use this dried sugar for that. So before you run out and make the purchase, let me share some additional details that I've read on the internet. So they must be true, right? Yep, it's going to be one of those nights. So sometimes honey is a tough thing to deal with. I have honey in my desk at work, and there are times when it makes a sticky mess. You might think dried honey would be a better solution. Actually, yes, but in my mind, if you dehydrated honey, well, it would probably still be sticky. And we know that honey is hygroscopic because it is rich in fructose, so if you dried it out, wouldn't it still attract moisture? The answer is yes. So from honey.com, it says virtually all dried honey products mix the dehydrated honey with other ingredients to keep it from becoming one big sticky clump. Stabilizers like wheat starch, maltodextrin, and other items are mixed in to keep it from clumping, sometimes apparently in significant ratios to the dehydrated powder. The honey.com fact sheet indicates that most dried honey formulations contain 50, 65, even 70% or more of honey in the ratio to the other products. So if it's one of those higher percentages, it's probably not that objectionable. I guess the guidance here is read the label and make sure that dried honey is listed as the primary ingredient. Another thing to know about these products is their final form. There are three predominant textures: powders, flakes, and granules. And I'm guessing they vary by manufacturer and process by which they're dehydrated. The product that I saw was small, tiny, off-white pebbles. The fact sheet indicates that the color of the product will vary by production method and vendor. It says it can vary from a light in color golden yellow to even a tan or a brown. The good news is that the color is not an indication of the quality or honey content. Sitting alongside the honey container in the store was a product called Cactus Honey Powder. While this product is similar to honey powder made from dehydrated honey, it is not honey, but agave nectar. Apparently, it stems from the juice of the agave cactus plants and is not produced by bees. If you're looking for a bee-based honey substitute, Cactus Honey Powder is not it. Now that I know what I was looking at, I might pick some up the next time I get in there to try it. I so want to get away from artificial sweeteners, but can't seem to adapt to the taste of honey in my coffee. Maybe this is a viable alternative, and I'm interested in finding out. I do know one thing. I'm glad I held off on buying something until I knew which was what. Like the mayonnaise example, choosing that cactus package would have been comparable to selecting Miracle Whip. And everyone knows that Hellman's is mayonnaise. So look to our show notes for a link to the fact sheet from honey.com. As I said earlier, our show notes can be found on our website, bkcorner.org. Look for episode number 46. For segment number two, I want to fall into the major feature of this episode, CCD Research, the refresher. This is where the title More to Come comes from. And you'll hear through the middle of this is that I think we're just scratching the surface when it comes to CCD. There have been a number of studies coming out that are backing up the prevailing wisdom that the systemic problems in how bees are managed are possibly related, and that it is a combination of these SID management practices and not one magic bullet that will solve the recent decline in honeybee. Thinking back, our first bees in our apiary arrived April 26, 2008, 5 years ago. That means my local yard. The cause of our personal participation as beekeepers was directly related to the appearance of CCD and New Jersey's program to increase beekeeper populations in bees in the Garden State. Colony Collapse Disorder, or CCD as it is known as, became a phenomena in 2006 in the United States, and surprisingly, the state of New Jersey's program was probably one of the first line responses to address the issue. Another way to think about this is to follow the money. There was funding to operate this program in New Jersey, and that in itself is an interesting development. Imagine that. New Jersey had a pretty timely reaction to the plight. 2 years after CCD broke, they spun up a response and their solution was in execution. I say to New Jersey, not too shabby. Good for you. The program I'm speaking of centered on a free course to train the basics of beekeeping. And for those that signed up, they were given a free beehive, equipment, bees and all. This is how we got started in our local apiary. Now, as Sharon and I got involved in our local association after becoming beekeepers, it started to engage in the beekeeping community at large. There was visibility to the groundswell about CCD by what we observed in what seems not so long ago, but truth could be remarked that they were early days of the response of the world to CCD. The U.S. was trying to figure out how to manage the mystery that was CCD. I recall reading about the CAP process, C-A-P, and what was being done about CCD in one of the first bee culture magazines I received when we started into beekeeping. So for the record, I think the CAP process was pretty intelligent response and an early realization that there was no clear leader in the cause, but researchers had a lot of valid suspicions. So incidentally, CAP is an acronym that stands for Coordinated Agricultural Project, and I'll explain more about this in a moment. If you think about something that has the potential scope of impact as CCD does, you can imagine when the crisis arrives that a number of researchers who could know or do something about it will have some sort of reaction to it. I would assume that anyone that was working with bees in research field at that time immediately would want to bear arms and roll up their sleeves. So presumably the same could be said about the government agencies that oversee this area, and more specifically the U.S. Department of Agriculture and the state agricultural boards. This phenomena, which is my word, was becoming more prevalent and mainstream. And then in 2007, the press started picking it up. Beekeepers were becoming more vocal, and the public began an outcry and reaction to save the bees. Part of the reason I bring this all is some of you have not been here that long. 2007 wasn't that long ago, but, you know, as 2007 rolled along, the logical progression of events was to triage this problem and decide what to do about it. Define what it was, determine the scale and potential impact, and along the way, plan for how to muster an appropriate response. In a recollection of the timetable of events from the U.S. Department of Agriculture, from now on I'll call them the USDA, there was a series of meetings between scientists, researchers, apiary inspectors, beekeepers, and just straight up industry representatives in the winter of 2006 and 2000 and the spring of 2007. In addition, there was a deliberation for 2.5 days at the Beltsville, Maryland Bee Lab, where participants provided several recommendations for research that was needed to better understand the problem. 5 things were called out at that time: pests, microbial bee diseases, pesticides, nutrient deficiencies, and other management stresses imposed upon bees. That's important to follow because those 5 things will turn up over and over again. So the government response was to write a national CCD action plan and prioritize a federal strategy for research needed to address CCD. This led to the formation of a committee called the National CCD Steering Committee. The chain of events kicked off from those sessions and other sessions were the start of federal funding led by the USDA, which was, as they stated, quote, the principal source of federal funding for research and other programs designed to protect and conserve pollinators, end quote. This is where the CAP response kicks in. Between 2008 and 2012, there was a $4.1 million grant to Keith Delaplane at the University of Georgia, a $5 million grant to Dennis Van Engelsdorp, now of the University of Maryland, and a $3.3 million grant to Dr. Ann Averill at the University of Massachusetts. In addition, there were some smaller grants for several programs that amounted to $500,000. So all in all, there was an $8.8 million outlay, if I did the math right. The Managed Pollinator CAP program used the USDA, National Institute of Food and Agriculture, or NIFA, grant as the engine to fund all this research that we're now seeing the benefits of. So I want to call something out about the way these funds were distributed. There is a key to the C in CAP, and it stands for coordinated. Kevin Moment. That rhymes with P. And I'm in a mood tonight. Sometimes I get that way when I record. If you've ever seen The Music Man, you'll know what I mean. Anyway, end of Kevin Moment. I said earlier that it was a smart response, and now I'm going to share what I meant by that. These grants were provided to researchers, but they were really not only given to the names mentioned, but to a larger subset of researchers who all worked on the research in a distributed manner. If you think about this in a different way, what could have happened is that University A could have applied for a grant and got to work on the bee nutrition suspicion. While that was going on, University B, C, and D could have done the same thing. While some of this may have happened, the CAP project divided up the work and assigned certain aspects, presumably by expertise, to the various researchers involved and coordinated the disparate but managed research back to the greater CAP oversight. Very smart. For a practical explanation, let me present an example of a specific topic. Pesticides and their involvement in CCD. The task of looking at this potential cause of CCD was handled by Penn State University. Jim Fraser, Chris Mullen, Mary Ann Fraser, and Sarah Ashcraft published the results of this particular subset of work under the CAP grant overseen by Keith Delaplane. Okay, let me come back to center for a moment now that the baseline is in place and get to what I wanted to convey in this segment. In the beginning sessions that happened in 2006 and 2007, there was a suspicion that there was not one silver bullet, but many factors coming together in the proverbial last straw to break the camel's back. In retrospect, it appears now that the researchers' hunches were right. I have to wonder if they systematically tried to cover all their bases, but it turns out, synergistically, all of these things were working in concert to bring the bees down. We spoke in our last episode about the research of honey upregulating the gene detoxification system and the impact the industry is having by using other products for supplemental feeding. One straw in the nutrition area. I mentioned the CAP research of Jim Fraser and others from Penn State. Another straw, but in the pesticide area. At the ABF convention in January, I sat in on a number of ongoing research projects related to the microbial bee diseases. Yet another straw. The original five suspected factors, and I would venture to guess maybe a few more, were spot on given the results of the research that is now coming to fruition. So I'm not here to tell you the cause of CCD, but to warn you that it takes time for the research to progress. And given the time frame that has passed since the beginning of the funding, results are now starting to come in. I want you to consider this background and be skeptical to some extent when somewhere in the mainstream press a declaration is made that the cause of CCD is now known because some research came back and it showed the impact to the bees. The fact of the matter is there have been a number of these declarations as of late, and when taken in isolation make one get all warm and fuzzy inside, but when taken in aggregate make me think, I'm confused. If that's the cause of CCD over there, then what's this cause I'm reading about over here? What's one to think? And the public keeps coming to me, people I see at work or whatever, and say, did you read they found the cause of CCD? No. The one thing that Randy Oliver said to me when I had the fortune of him staying at my house last year sticks with me about this topic. I'll paraphrase my thoughts on this. In other words, these are my words, not his. Answers only provide the opportunity for more questions. For everything they learn, it takes us on a path of discovery to understand more things. This problem is going to be solved by a comprehensive understanding of a complex biology of bees if we're ever to understand not only what causes the problem, but how to fix it. For what I think We are fortunate that so much research is going on. Now, I won't declare that there's no stone unturned, but it appears that CCD has brought an unprecedented amount of research about honeybees, probably like no other time period in history. So let me restate that for a moment, because this is an important aspect. There was like this honeymoon period where the von Frisches, Langstroth, Ware, Huber, and others did foundational work that we still rely upon today. But over time, I would think the been there, done that notion of fundamental research is in the vault. I can't imagine that anyone would have done such an intensive, diverse, and frankly as well-funded body of work for the honeybees in this time and age if CCD hadn't come along. So it's not a new concept, so I won't take credit for it, but many do think that CCD is a bit of a gift to beekeepers. If anything, it does no harm to solidify, in the public space, the importance of honeybees and, quite frankly, provide a wake-up call to all of mankind globally about the importance of pollinator insects. Good or bad, the prevalence of CCD is actually waning. The USDA reported that CCD is occurring with diminishing frequency. The number of reported cases was sharply decreased by 2010, and in the winter of 2010-2011, starvation was cited as the most frequent cause of bee losses by those surveyed. And CCD, it came in seventh overall on the list of reported causes. That being said, we are by no means out of the woods. I've heard a different tone at times about CCD. Yes, CCD is a real phenomena, but truth be told, the large losses that don't fit the CCD pattern, meaning beekeepers are losing large subsets of colonies year on year, are as much of a concern as the dreaded CCD patterns that started the whole thing. The pressures of Varroa provided a 1-2 punch on top of CCD. Throw in uncertainties of pesticides, bee diseases, lack of diverse foraging, and you still have this soupy mess to address before beekeepers can see a viable chance to maintain some order in the keeping of bees. So here's where we get to more to come. So, going back to the thoughts about what is to come, I suspect that the researchers will continue to do research and bring results. There's a logical progression, and this might just be the first round of many rounds to come. Questions beget questions. As a good beekeeper, take in what you know, but think bigger picture. It seems reasonable in my eyes to take what is learned, see if there's something that can improve the situation and make use of it, keeping in mind all the while that there's likely more guidance to come. Incidentally, think that more guidance to come and the guidance that has already come in is the reason we saw lesser CCD and more of a shift as to what's causing the problems. It appears, and the research seems to support it, that this is a compilation of things and not one single answer to the plight of bees, and my only worry is that someone will prematurely declare victory on some facet of the problem, and that will cut off funding for the real answer to come. There's another upside, a new dynamic that CCD has brought to the picture for the first time in history. Because there needed to be mechanisms to determine the plight of the honeybees, new ways to count the losses have been baselined and tracked year after year since the start. Metrics on bee losses are the barometer on whether the problem has truly been solved. So CCD causes this country to derive reports on losses, and the metrics will shed light on the resolution. See, fortunately, it seems sometimes you can't declare victory when a large year-over-year losses continue to be reported. The fact that we now have metrics, when we didn't before CCD, is a good thing and could provide that much-needed visibility to keep the research funding. It seems, and I'm simplifying, the first round of the fight is done and the scorecards are in. We can't tell how many rounds this will take, but hopefully someone won't turn the lights out before the fight is over. Certainly, we have to hope that humans don't lose sight on how vital pollinators are. Segment number 3, Nozema pesticide link. In segment 2, we just spoke about a combination of factors that is likely at the root of CCD and making bees susceptible to problems or collapse. A paper released in January 2012 is one of those research projects that coincides with an important link to one of the 5 suspect areas of CCD, pesticides. The paper, Pesticide Exposure in Honeybees Results in Increased Levels of the Gut Pathogen Nozema, draws a conclusion that the exposure to one of the most widely used pesticides results in significantly higher levels of Nozema in the bee gut. This paper is available on Springer, on the Springer website, and is published from Jeffrey Pettis of the USDA ARSB Research Laboratory in Beltsville, Maryland, and in cooperation from 3 principals slash contributors from the Department of Entomology, different offices, University of Maryland, one of them is Dennis Van Engelsdorp, Josephine Johnson, and Gail Dively, hopefully I pronounced her name right one of those times. For 10 weeks, the scientists expose full-size colonies of bees. Wait a second, Kevin, moment. Scientists or researchers? I never know which term to use. Hopefully they won't be offended if they ever hear this. End of Kevin moment. For 10 weeks, the researchers expose the full-size colonies of bees to the neonicotinoid pesticide imidacloprid via supplemental feeding patties, pollen patties. When comparing control colonies against the spike colonies, they demonstrated that the sublethal levels of neonicotinoids caused the bees to develop both Nozema serrani and Nozema apis spore infections. In addition to the standard control hive, the testing provided 2 sets of experiment colonies where bees were given low and high doses of imidacloprid, respectively. The conclusion from the researchers, quote, "We clearly demonstrate an interaction between sublethal exposures to imidacloprid at the colony level and the spore production in individual bees of the honeybee gut parasite Nozema," end quote. We've talked about Nozema before on the podcast, but as a refresher, bees ingest a spore from drinking water that has been polluted by infected feces or cleaning out cells which have feces inside or a myriad of other spore exposures in the hive ecosystem. The spores make their way into the midgut, which is where the bees digest pollen and honey. Spores germinate in this section of the digestive tract and send out long, thin tubes called the polar filament. These spores can hijack a bee's cells and generate new forms, which eventually could take over the midgut of the bee. The spores lodge into the cells of the midgut and make them split open when they infect them. For what it's worth, Nozema is often present in bees, but large infestations do considerable damage and shortens the bee's life. It is such a concern that many other research projects have been conducted or are underway about Nozema and its impact on the bees. Case in point, the paper goes on to call out this study against 2 other similar studies conducted in previous years, which came to similar conclusions about the synergistic nature of imidacloprid and Nozema. There was a distinct difference in the approach between these studies, this study and the other ones. In this study, the bees received the pesticide exposure indirectly from brood food from nurse bees and were exposed when they were fed imidacloprid spiked protein by the nurse bees. So think about how that works. The nurse bees eat the pollen spiked with imidacloprid, and in the brood food that they prepare for the larvae, they are feeding imidacloprid indirectly. In the other studies conducted, it appears that the imidacloprid was delivered via a sugar solution and not pollen patties. And apparently that makes a difference. So no matter what the study was, the results were significantly weakened immune system of the honeybees. One of the aforementioned studies was conducted by Cedric Allaux from France, A-L-A-U-X. In this study, it was confirmed that the combination of Nozema and imidacloprid significantly decreased the activity of glucose oxidase. This is an important enzyme that allows the bees to sterilize their colony and brood food. Without this enzyme, bees can become more susceptible to infections by pathogens. If memory serves me right, this might have been the same thing that is equivalent to hydrogen peroxide when the bees break it down that we mentioned in the last episode, but sometimes my memory doesn't serve me right. So going back to the feature study, one of the observations was that imidacloprid residues could not be found in the newly emerged worker bees, but this sublethal exposure in brood food to the larvae resulted in increased spore production in adult bees. One of the key things to think about this is how realistic the delivery method is. In the other study, the exposure was through sugar solution. This was through pollen, which is realistic as neonicotinoid-treated plants have the exposure throughout the plant, including pollen. This means that this isn't a lab-based conclusion. It's highly probable in nature that the bees could pick up imidacloprid coming out of the pollen and bring it back and create this same situation that turned up in this study. On the other respect, I guess they could pick up nectar, but I'm not sure that imidacloprid is transmitted as much through the nectar as it is through the pollen. So I'm going to sidebar here for a moment. In 2011, I went to see Mary Ann Fraser speak, and one of the things she mentioned was the potential for synergistic effect with compounds that, you know, could be combined with other factors going on inside the hive. This is a valid example of a synergistic effect between imidacloprid and Nozema. And it wasn't related to the things that she called out. The focus, what she was working on, was about fungicides, which is also possible. So, wow, what kind of soup is this? Nozema has always been on the radar. It's widely publicized that Nozema was found in the initial colonies that were sampled for CCD. So I'm going to read you something that's widely documented. Quote, of 30 CCD-affected colonies observed, 100% were positive for Nozema serrani and 90% for Nozema apis. End quote. That is from the research of the initial CCD scan that they did when CCD samples were taken from the field. So this particular paper concludes with this statement. Quote, we suggest new pesticide testing standards be devised that incorporate increased pathogen susceptibility into the test protocols. Lastly, we believe that subtle interactions between pesticides and pathogens, such as demonstrated here, could be a major contributor to increased mortality of honeybee colonies worldwide. End quote. If you think about it, in the end, Nozema adds stress to the bees, and their inability to absorb nutrition because of the thin tubes crisscrossing the midgut, and it is a significant concern to the health and longevity of the bees that are widely infected. Another concern that I have is you can't see it without a microscope, so we, as beekeepers, are oblivious to the harm that is right under our noses. I want to believe, and I've said it here before, we can't see it, so we really can't do anything about it. I can't live my life fretting that our bees are going to die any moment now because they're loaded with Nozema spores. I only hope that you and I are fortunate enough to have bees that can somehow cope with any exposures while scientists/researchers try to figure out solutions. I think we owe an appreciation to the researchers in providing the insights that can drive informed decisions. And I say, add another study to the pile of links for CCD, but don't declare victory. Boy, we have a lot of work to do, and what a mess of things we've made. As a final note, I start to think about how we can cut to the chase. My brain wonders if the situation in France will show improvement due to the fact that they have banned imidacloprid. One less straw on the camel's back for that country. Hopefully, someone is thinking about and funding the research to determine the impacts by studying what's going on in that country explicitly, and then they could draw the correlation back. So I'll provide a link to the summary of recent neonicotinoid research that I came across. And again, I keep in mind that this is a potential avenue for CCD, but adds to the whole synergistic theme that we have going on in this episode. Three segments down, let's move into roundtable and run off a couple topics that we have to close out the episode. First one is moisture board. Have you ever heard of a moisture board? Up until recently, I had not. I posted a video we shot this past summer where presenter Landy Simone showed a piece of wood fiber that was used at the top of a hive to manage moisture control. We're fond of saying around here that moisture kills bees during the winter, not the cold. There are certain construction substrates that seem to absorb moisture. If you've ever left a fiber board outside over winter, you'll know what I mean. They're hygroscopic and will grow when they get wet. This proposed solution works the same way as it wicks out the moisture of the hive and then gives it off at the edges that are exposed to the outside air. I guess I wonder why it doesn't wick moisture into the board from the exposure outside, but my thoughts are that it will wax and wane when it comes to the moisture, and typically winters are cold and dry, so the moisture in the months where the humidity is low would mean wicking out of the hive and releasing to the outside air. The product featured in her presentation was a 3/4-inch fiber board, and you can find it under the trade name BuildRite. BuildRite. I found a website on the web that explains how to construct one of these fiber boards, and you know the drill. For the link, you could visit our show notes. The BuildRite company has a website. BuildRite Sheathing's website is buildrite.com/sheathing, sheathing.htm. You could also go back to that source video that I mentioned from Landy Simone. It's posted up on our YouTube channel, youtube.com/nwnjba, and look for the nucleus hive discussion that is posted up there. She did a presentation, and this is near the end of that presentation if you want to see it. Roundtable number two, a hot Aussie. A short while ago, a solicitation went out to the New Jersey Beekeepers Association for an observation hive for the Dr. Oz television show. I threw a hat in the ring for an offer to help out, but as it was, we didn't get the call. The episode, which was taped a couple weeks back, aired recently, and Dr. Oz discussed and reviewed the beneficial aspects of honey on the show. A cool component of the feature was the sidebar they did at Mehmet's home, where he has a few hives on his property. The feature ended with Dr. Oz making his version of a drink called the Hot Toddy. His version left aside the alcohol, but still kept the tradition of honey and lemon in hot water. Unfortunately, Sharon has a slight cold over the past few days, and this afternoon she made herself, and lucky for me, Dr. Oz's concoction. But we did a little twist. A hot toddy is typically honey, water, and lemon, with some spices mixed in if you're ambitious. Dr. Oz called his version the Hot Aussie, and it contained 1 tablespoon of natural honey, you know, something from a beekeeper, not from the supermarket, of course. Hot water, but not boiling. You don't want to kill the goodness of the honey by adding boiling water. And a lemon wedge, or you could squeeze 2 teaspoons of lemon juice. Preferably you're using fresh lemon. He said optionally you can add some vodka or whiskey as the Scottish used to do, but most don't recommend alcohol when you have a cold as it dehydrates you. The little twist I spoke of is using lemon zest in addition to lemon juice. Lemon zest has a way in my mind of making things more lemony, if that makes sense. I happen to have one sitting right here next to me, and I've got a little shot of whiskey in it, and maybe that's why I'm so joyous this evening. Don't do that very often, but every once in a while you got to try these recipes out for science. So the next time you're feeling a little under the weather, think about a hot Aussie. You'll be glad you did. We'll provide a link in our shows to Dr. Oz's website. There you can check out his feature, 5 Health Uses for Honey. Roundtable number 3, I wanted to talk about movie night. We did a meeting with our association the other day, and we did it inside a school cafeteria. And the problem there is just horror when it comes to acoustics, and it didn't go so well. We knew from the sign-up that we were going to get a large participation, and we had a room of about 50 people. The projector, the screen, even the sound system and everything was set up perfectly, but the problem was the video had a pretty terrible or not so good audio quality, and that was compounded by the fact that the acoustics in the room were so poor that it just could not work. What we had was a wireless microphone system broadcasting to several speakers. There were 3 or 4 out through the room, but for whatever reason, it just did not transcribe very well. And depending on where you were sitting, we just didn't cover the room very good. So speakers and sound seem to be the biggest problem for this. We've been looking at, and I don't know if anybody has solutions out there, a Sonos or a product called Logitech Squeeze. These are things that allow you to, audio enable your house. So you put one central box and it transcribes out to different speakers. And I think we could get this solved if we had even more speakers. And somewhere along the line, we probably have to mix in an amplifier or something to get this working right. I guess my request is out to you guys for a change. If you have any insights on how to solve this problem, please let us know, as we're really looking to see if we can get a better solution going. I've been looking at large-scale 1,000-watt speakers on Amazon and other things, but I'm wondering whether I need something powerful to drive them. So if I have any audiophiles out there or anybody that has any insights on this, please, write me a note. Let me know if you have any thoughts or solutions for us. So the presentation was on Michael Palmer's suggestion of how to use Nucleus hives in your apiary. That is probably going to be our next episode feature. We're going to do a run-through of what he covered. Pretty insightful guy, Michael Palmer. Just has a way to communicate in a plain spoken language and get his point across. And I think the guy does enough management of bees that he just gets it. He has the experience, and that's a revelation that's come recently, is maybe one of the things that would help is just being that type of person, somebody who's constantly working with hundreds and hundreds of hives. I could imagine that the learning curve would be just phenomenal if you got into that aspect, but don't have that opportunity, and I'll continue to follow the path that I have. But whenever I hear someone like Michael Palmer speak, you could certainly understand that my ears are open and I'm trying to absorb as much as he's given. So if you have the opportunity to hear Michael Palmer speak, please take that opportunity. Very sage advice given by him. And the thing about Michael Palmer, I don't know him, never worked with him, don't know what his methods are, but everything that he says, just what I know, makes sense, you know? There's very few people who can convey what they're doing and back it up with the beekeeping experience that Michael Palmer has. So kudos to him, and if you have the chance, again, go look him up on YouTube and watch a couple of his videos, and you'll be a fan too. Roundtable number 4. I was recently contacted by the Girl Scouts of Lexington, Kentucky. They asked me to post a link for a free resource guide to beekeeping under the answers.com web properties. You know, it's about 3 or 4 times a year some organization shares an email with me about our podcast effort and asks us on their behalf to post a link. And I have honored a number of these requests in the past and wish these organizations the best when they contact us out of the blue. Most times it's an educator working with youth on the topic of bees, and I applaud them for their services. If I can do anything to post that link and make somebody's day, that really is the least that I could do for the service to the bees as they're educating the youth. So here's a shout out to the Girl Scouts of Lexington, Kentucky. Keep up the good work, ladies. So we're getting close to filling the hour, so I'll see if I can wrap this up. I wanted to finish off with one final topic unrelated to beekeeping, but just make a note that the last 2 weeks I got summoned to jury duty, and I went through all the steps of, how do you say it? It's like the 7 steps of something. Very fascinating process. Got called out there, never thought I'd get picked. Then went through the shock and awe of being picked. And I mean, they pick you from the audience and you're not allowed to leave. You're hustled into a jury room, and then you come out and you start listening to testimony. They don't fool around. And this was a U.S. District Court for a criminal charge against a contractor for kickbacks and bribes. I spent the last 2 weeks going through, I didn't want to use the right terminology. I felt like a prisoner. You get there in the morning and you do exactly what they say until they release you when they're done with the specific aspect of the case that day. In the end, I was actually supposed to go through to Thanksgiving and all of next week and the following week, but it turns out that the defendant somewhere in the middle had a change of heart and decided to plead guilty to some of the charges against him. And I'm not sure if that's in favor of a lesser sentence or he just felt that things were not going his way. Without getting into the specifics of who it was and what it's about, the trial was extremely fascinating. The FBI had witnesses that were cooperating with them from previous times when these people were caught on tape doing corrupt activities, and they had them go in and tape a contractor using audio and video of some sort of bribe scheme that was going on in 2 separate occasions. One of them was with a terminal facility in the Port of Elizabeth, and the other one was the New Jersey Department of Transportation. And the way the attorneys work, the way the witnesses work, the way the court conducts the business, the recording systems, the interaction with jurors, I have to tell you, it was an enlightening experience. I'm not sure whether I liked it or absolutely thought it was fascinating and enjoyed it. I can't tell yet. I guess time will tell how I stand on that. But I am proud to have served my civic duty. And if you ever get called for jury duty, everybody's first reaction is, no, the horror of it. I don't want to serve. But the fact of the matter is, it's a fascinating, if you're fortunate, I guess sometimes people get selected for things that are not so friendly, but in this case, I really enjoyed the experience and got to see a side of something I've never seen before. I've always been a rescue volunteer, fire department, rescue squad, and also 911 operator, which kind of disqualified me from any of that business, and I've never ever received a summons for jury duty, but just recently got it. My understanding is I have a 3-year moratorium before they'll call me back for the next thing, but who knows how that works. That's just hearsay amongst all the jurors. What was most enjoying was after the fact we were allowed to talk amongst ourselves and with some of the people in the court about what our impressions were. And I have to say, I have my opinion whether he was guilty or not. I thought it was pretty clear, and I was hoping everybody was going to come to that same conclusion, but again, in respect of what was going on and the fact that he hasn't been sentenced yet, I'll keep that mum. Anyway, that's going to bring to close this episode. We hope you enjoyed what we brought. Got a pile of stuff ready to go for our next go-round. And I think at then, I won't mess around. I'll just close it here. Thanks, everybody, for listening. And we'll catch you next time on the Beekeeper's Corner podcast. Bye, everyone.